Hello and welcome to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 96, where apparently workflows can be weaponized. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As you were mentioning, GitHub workflows can be weaponized, and we have people who are really overconfident in their security measures, and we're also taking a look at AT&T about the breach they suffered. No, not that one. No, not the other one either. No, this is a new one. So yeah, we'll be covering that and if something else if we have time.
It almost seems like if a company suffers a breach, there's this figurative bullseye on their back forever going forward. We'll talk about those stories. Just real quick, just want to mention a few things for those of you that aren't already aware. Merch.learnlinux.tv. I have some new products there, including an Enterprise Linux Security shirt, among many others. Fanny packs. Come on. We need to bring fanny packs back. Come on. We need fanny packs. Drinkware, all kinds of things with Linux logos on them, some without, some are just pop culture relevant. It's a lot of fun. So check it out. Support the channel. Merch.learnlinux.tv. I'd really appreciate it. Secondly, for some strange reason, I had a really big boost of productivity and I completed two courses on Udemy within the they're released within the scope of a month. I don't think that'll ever happen again, but you guys can benefit because I'll be making courses in the future, but not this many at once. But Udemy has two new courses for me, one for Ansible, the other for the Linux Essentials certification through LPI. And by the way, there's also a discount code on the website if anyone is about to take the test. So check out my new courses. The links are there on the website. Just hover over courses, and then down at the bottom, you'll see my two new Udemy courses, and I'd really appreciate it if you check it out. And with all that said, let's get into the security shenanigans.
Okay, so this week we have a company that did a survey looking at GitHub Actions, and GitHub Actions are part of GitHub Workflows, which is a fancy name of saying the automatic stuff that happens behind the scenes whenever you commit code and GitHub tries to compile it. And basically this is a type of... supply chain, not attack, but supply chain vulnerability testing, if you want to call it that. What's the expected result when you start looking at the security aspect of anything today? Obviously, they found some flaws, and we're being quite nice about it by calling it just flaws. So apparently, there were about 2.5 million files that they checked. They probably scanned the whole of GitHub, of which 7,000 workflows had untrusted input interpolation, which is a funny way of saying that basically it took input and used that as parameters on whatever scripts they were running without doing any checks. So basically SQL injection, but for GitHub Actions. Another 2,500 executed untrusted code. Basically, it was calling some type of tool or application or part of the build output and using it in the pipeline directly without any type of check. So whatever was there to execute, they would simply run it. And then another 3,000 used untrustworthy artifacts, which is another fancy way. And why do they use many fancy ways of addressing stuff here? Which is another fancy way of saying that they were using... actions from not confirmed GitHub users. So basically the random GitHub user that's just signed up, has an account, creates some GitHub action files, and they pick those files and use them for their own pipelines. Not the most secure approach, and we'll be taking a look at why.
It's interesting. I don't feel like this gets a lot of attention in the media, probably because of marketing. I mean, we have these turnkey solutions or these cloud solutions like workflows that could, take a CI/CD system that in the past you might have done manually or set up locally, but, it's almost like CI/CD as a service. In fact, that's exactly what it is. And the thing that I don't think gets enough attention is that, yes, it's useful, but how secure is it? Everyone's happy to use it. Everyone's excited when we have a new technology, but we need to really think about it in terms of, but what is the threat surface of this and how do we mitigate the threat surface getting bigger because we're using more things within the cloud environment? As the complexity goes up, as the components goes up, any one of those components could be used against you. So as you're adding components, you're potentially adding, places of impact.
Basically, whenever you're adding layers of complexity to a process, you're probably adding inherent flaws and again, security problems with it. We keep on adding layers and layers and layers to everything that we do in IT. The CI/CD pipeline is just a fancy way of saying, yeah, we have automatic scripts that run whenever we commit code. And we have a whole bunch of possible triggers and hooks where we can pin those scripts and have them run and perform different tasks. It can do anything from spell checking the code to making it pretty to making sure that we're following the company's tabs versus space rules or just whatever else we want to check. And it can do, it can look for bugs, it can look for security problems, it can do a whole different set of things. But all of those scripts are code themselves, all of the applications that are called from the scripts are another layer of security problems that you might be pulling in. So just like dependencies, whenever you're adding stuff to your code that's not exactly your code, at some point you're adding uncertainty and you're adding stuff that can fail and you might not realize it at the moment.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And we have to keep in mind that any tool that we use can be used against us. We always have to think about that. We want to implement this. Okay, great. It does what we want it to do, but what's the trade-off here? There's always a trade-off. Even if you don't know there's a trade-off, a vulnerability that's not been discovered is a trade-off. So, you know, there's always a trade-off when it comes to these types of things. And sometimes I wonder, with all the time and energy we're putting into using things like workflows, and then just to have a vulnerability or some kind of breach, which is going to add more time, at what point do we say that some of these turnkey solutions that are supposed to save us work create more work in the long run? Because it kind of seems like it's getting to that point to me.
There was a lively discussion a couple of days back on Twitter about some people claiming that Git hooks are something that you should avoid, and others saying that, yeah, but you can do this and that and all of that. But they were actually, everybody seemed to be missing the point. It's an added layer of stuff that you need to maintain, and it's another layer of stuff that you need to code. It's another layer of stuff that you need to test, and you need to keep that in mind whenever you're developing. Of course, if you have a large enough team, that's probably justified. You have an engineer or two taking a look at those and getting those ready, and then everybody relies on it and uses it, but you have people that are responsible just for maintaining the tool set, and that's part of the tool set. So in that specific situation, sure, that might be helpful. As long as you have the ability to keep maintaining it and keeping an eye on it if it breaks over time, then yeah, by all means, do move ahead with it. Some other interesting aspects that this survey found was that 98% of references used by the jobs and the steps do not follow dependency pinning best practices. Again, what all of this means is that they simply included a dependency to a given tool, but they didn't specify which version of that tool that they wanted to use. The default setting here is that you'll always pull the latest version. And for most people, the initial response to that, yeah, great, the latest version has all the latest, greatest fixes and security fixes, and that's the one that I want to be running. However, as we've seen very recently in recent supply chain issues that we've covered here in the podcast, if a tool becomes malicious, say by somebody acquiring the repository, changing the code, introducing some security problems to it, then pulling the latest version will get that malicious version in. Probably a more sane approach to dependencies here might be, yeah, I'm going to pull the same version that I've tested against and that I know is good because I've already run all of my checks and my security checks on it, and I know that that version is trustworthy. If that version does what you want, if you keep up with the news around it that there are no new threats on that specific version, then it's perfectly fine to keep using an older version of software.
Yeah.
Because of that, because it's really tricky to keep up with all of the changes, it's really tricky to check each and new version, and if you just pull it automatically, the latest one, then yeah, you might get in trouble because of it.
Another surprising thing about this, and this isn't all that important, it's just kind of funny, I wasn't aware that including dependencies, even worked 98% of the time, let alone 98% of the people, you know, not even using best practices. I mean, I've seen countless developers pin a library version just because they couldn't get it to compile, you know, and 98% aren't even like paying attention. Like, I didn't even realize that dependency management ever got that good to begin with. But I digress. I mean, if you have one library, it's not that hard to make sure that there's no vulnerabilities. Two, sure. 10, maybe. Okay, now we're starting to get a little bit into the heavier workload. And then the more libraries on top of that, the more complex the app, the more libraries you need. And then next thing you know, you have a ginormous number of libraries to maintain. And it is something. And now another thing that's interesting to me is that I feel like, at least in my experience, most organizations are used to, I don't know if I want to call it a gatekeeper, like in a Windows domain, you have the person or maybe a team of people that are testing the updates before they roll them out to the entire company, because they know from experience, yes, it fixes a security bug, but maybe, you know, we'll just kind of roll it out depending on the how critical it is. So there's this layered update approach. Like, people understand that updates in corporate IT are finicky. So that's another reason why I feel like 98% is kind of different, because, I mean, I thought it was generally agreed upon in most organizations that you have a team of guinea pigs that get their Windows updates first and then followed by the rest of the companies. So to not have a gatekeeper in front of a library in a, you know, in enterprise IT is kind of interesting to me why that isn't more common.
And keep in mind that this specific problem that we're looking at, the GitHub Actions and the workflows, this isn't something that you pull to your system and you run locally. This is something that runs on GitHub systems, on GitHub servers directly. So essentially, you're not pulling a dependency and adding it to your code, where you could, for example, just pull the code directly for the dependency and compile it yourself and include the output from that compilation. Here, you're pulling a tool and running that tool on GitHub systems. So there's less visibility into what it's doing than if you were doing it locally. It's really important to keep that in mind as well. Another thing that the study mentions that I found interesting is that 86% of workflows do not limit token permissions. This is similar to always running every single command on as root on a Linux system. So if you always run as root, then you'll never get the permission denied on a Linux system. However, if you mess up something, then you really mess up something. Having tokens that have just full permissions to do everything and using those in your workflows, that's opening the door for two things. First, any mistake becomes catastrophic. And secondly, if that workflow gets compromised somehow, you've just handed the keys to the kingdom. You really want to limit the scope of the tokens, or else you might as well just use the full permissions for the user account directly and not use tokens altogether.
Yeah, or just leak it onto the dark web on behalf of the threat actors to save them the work, because it's going to end up there anyway. There's just so much to be said about this, but, you know, it doesn't give me much confidence to rely on another platform to make the right decision. You know, it's one thing where the cloud, especially when it came out, is marketed as this, you know, thing you can use to avoid having to manage hardware and manage this and manage that, and everything is going to get better. It'll walk your dog and do your dishes and everything else too. But the reality is that, you know, that the term or the phrase "someone else's computer" rings very true. I never had a problem with that, because that's the whole point. Some people want it to be someone else's computer because they don't want to maintain the computer. But if the person on the other end is not doing the right thing, as we're going to talk about with Snowflake later, it gets harder and harder to trust cloud providers. And I wouldn't be surprised if many organizations just get to a point where they're just going to bring things in-house or just stop using something like GitHub Workflows, GitHub Actions, and GitLab has their own version of the same thing, and just start manually, you know, managing dependencies rather than have someone else deal with it if they don't do a good job. So I feel like if the cloud industry wants to maintain their status as the turnkey solution they want it to be, they're going to have to bring their A game when it comes to managing their own offerings.
I mean, if you're running this type of things locally, you also need to do it correctly. I mean, if most of these problems, they don't necessarily exist because it's in the cloud. They exist because people are not following the practices that they should be following. I'm not going to call them best practices on purpose, but they are, I wouldn't say intentionally breaking the patterns, but they are not following the guidance that GitHub provides when you're creating this type of things. If you're careful on how you do it, again, if you have the resources to allocate to this, not just as an afterthought, but as something that you really want to integrate into your workflow, then you should do it properly. You should look up how to properly create the tokens and decide the permissions, how to properly look up at for the right actions to use, how to get the right tools to do what you want to do, and not just pick the first example that you see on a Stack Overflow answer or the first thing that ChatGPT spits out. You really need to spend the time and learn how it works properly. And again, for larger teams, it might be first easier to deploy correctly and give you more reward for what the effort that you're putting in, because it will be used by more users. It will provide better outcome for more users. For smaller teams, you really need to look if this is the best approach for what you're doing. Probably running some scripts locally after you deploy locally, or running the tests locally and not relying on what GitHub is providing, is a better alternative. It's not impossible to run this type of things locally and just deploy your own on premises. You'll have more control and probably won't be as exposed to the same problems. However, you still need to do it correctly, and you still need to be careful with what you're putting in your build process.
Absolutely. It's a responsibility regardless of where it is. It's either going to be your responsibility only, or it's going to be a shared responsibility like we talked about in a previous episode. And, you know, I think one thing to keep in mind, especially if there's a company out there that's, you know, not using cloud yet, or insert name of, you know, new solution here, and they want to get on board with it, they have to think about the now and then. Okay, now, is it going to save you money? Yeah, it might. It might save money in hardware. It might be a major benefit for you. But also think about the maintenance cost, when you have to check into things, how much does it cost to employ somebody to be a gatekeeper behind these things? Like, really understand the total cost, because far too many people stop at, it's going to save us money on servers, and they don't look at the business processes and how those things are going to change, because they basically want to implement cloud as soon as the white paper appears in their mailbox. But the reality is, we have to check these things. We can't just use the first thing that comes in our spam folder in our inbox. I'm talking about the CTOs or CEOs that aren't technical, not our audience, obviously. But these things do have to be checked. And there's never going to be a situation, to your point, where you won't have to check things. It doesn't matter if it's in the cloud. It doesn't matter if it's local, like you were saying. It needs to be checked. That's just the way it is.
And this transitions pretty nicely into the follow-up story, which is overconfidence in your own security measures. So there's a different study, a different survey where people were asked, people working in IT and different companies in different industries. We'll have the links for this in the description. I don't know if they're already there or not. They probably are. So there's this sense of overconfidence where 63% of companies believe that their data security measures are effective, despite the frequent ransomware attacks that we've reported constantly here in the podcast and we're seeing on the news every single day. 63% of companies believe that what they are doing is enough to protect them from this type of things. Okay, so here's the first spoiler. It's not. Probably the only reason why those 63% of companies still believe this is A, sheer luck, and B, you still haven't been targeted by a malicious threat actor. That's not necessarily the same as your protection being enough to stop this. There's this quote from, I don't know, this is very old, sometimes around Second World War. Again, I can't attribute this, so I better not quote it directly, but a sufficiently motivated attacker targeting a modern IT infrastructure with enough resources will always find a way in. Okay, I know this is a shock, this is a spoiler, this might make you think that I'm talking crazy here, but again, past evidence and recent attacks have shown us that this is very much true. sure, you want to delay this as much as possible. You want to add as many layers of security as possible. You want to do defense in depth. You want to have your perimeter firewalls. You want to have all the stuff on your individual hosts protected. You want to have patching up to snuff. You want to make sure that everything is done properly. That said, there's no one can protect you 100% of the time against any single threat out there, because you don't know what those threats are. Many things that can be used against you have never been used against anybody else, so if they are attempted, they might succeed. The amount of people that believe that what they are doing is enough is dangerous for one very important reason. If you believe that what you have is enough, you won't be looking to improve it. And that's a really dangerous mindset to have in cybersecurity. If you think that, okay, I don't need to do anything else because there's no way that I can be attacked, that my data is perfectly safe, then you will stop looking at better alternatives to do whatever you're doing. You'll stop looking for whatever else you can do on top of all of that. And you really should avoid that mindset. You really should always be looking at ways to improve what you have, to better secure your systems, because that's the only assured way that you can further delay whatever breach might happen in the future.
Absolutely. And as we've said many times, the only thing that separates you from, you know, someone breaking in is how determined the threat actor is. That's it. That's all it is. If a threat actor is determined, they will get in. And anytime I hear somebody, you know, mention any kind of confidence about security, what I think in my head immediately is how to say you don't know anything about security without saying you don't know anything about security. Because having any confidence means that, in my opinion, you don't understand security. Think of it this way. If the two guys that are doing a security podcast have no trust of security, there's no trust to be had, okay? We're educating people on security, okay? And we don't trust it. What does that tell you?
Probably that we need a different podcast or something, but yeah.
We're never going to run out of material. There's that. So.
I know this isn't a popular opinion. Every vendor out there is going to tell you that their solution is 100% foolproof and there's no way that it's going to break and all of that. But again, real world examples, the breaches that we've seen recently, the amount of technical innovation that we're seeing on the threat actor side, the difficulty even for companies with lots of resources to put into cybersecurity to avoid being breached because they have massive targets painted on their backs and they still fail at that. I mean, if Microsoft's CEO email has been compromised for months with threat actors reading whatever he's sending and receiving, then that's a pretty good indicator that, okay, first, Microsoft fumbled something, but secondly, that it's really difficult to get it right all the time. So you really, really need to avoid the mindset, okay, I'm secure, nobody's going to target me, I don't need to do anything else to remain secure. Constantly keeping vigilance and making sure that you're patched and that your applications are always running the latest and greatest version that you can deploy and making sure that everything is up to date and firewalls and antivirus and all of that is properly installed and deployed. The usual stuff. And that your employees are well trained, that you keep reminding them that you shouldn't click links on emails because that's the first attack vector. Again, the type of things that you need to constantly keep refreshing and keep insisting on. On the same survey, only 7% of organizations admitted that their measures are likely ineffective. 7% against 63% that believe they are. That's a very different approach there. I could make the obvious joke that, yeah, those 7% have already been hacked. So they know what they're up against. And that's why they don't trust it anymore. And the ones that are confident in this, we know what they are doing. 60% of those use role-based access controls. We've talked about this on the podcast. We have a dedicated episode just on that. Role-based access controls means that you don't assign privileges to specific users. You assign users to roles, and then you give privileges to those roles. It's an easier way to manage this. You never forget when deleting a user or a user leaves your organization. You never forget removing the privileges. You simply remove it from the group and the privileges go away. 58% employ data tagging and least privilege principles, meaning that you only have access to the data that you really need to have access to for your job. So you don't see everybody else's data, meaning that if your system, your personal workstation or your laptop or something gets compromised, then you don't get everybody else's data also compromised. Only 27% use data cataloging tools. These are tools that let you have an inventory of whatever you're managing in your infrastructure so that at all times you know what data you have. This is one of the things that you learn quickly enough when you start doing this job. If you don't know what you're managing, there's no way you can protect it. If I don't know how many systems I have, if I don't know how many servers I have and which servers those are, then there's no way I can manage them properly. I won't know if one of them is missing updates, or I won't know if one is missing a different tool. I won't know if it's in the alerts application or not. The same applies to data. If you don't know what data exists on a given file server, then there's no way that you can tell your CEO, yeah, we suffered a ransomware breach and this is what we lost. So in case something goes south, you won't be able to know exactly what was affected. This is really important stuff. And again, the type of thing that you start to realize only after you've suffered the breach. 28% use automated monitoring, 25% perform regular audits. All of these are great stuff. You should be doing all of them. But it shouldn't be such a small percentage of the respondents. Everybody should be doing this. This is like the scraping the bottom of the barrel here. These are the basic stuff that you should be doing. And with these small percentages and with just this type of techniques being used, we still have 63% that are confident in that this is enough. That's scary.
It is. It's another facepalm moment that we seem to find a lot of. Like I said, any confidence in security means you shouldn't have confidence in security. You shouldn't even be in security. At least you're new to it. I shouldn't say that. It means you're new to security. How about that's a nicer way to put it.
Again, I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't be doing something like this. You just shouldn't be confident that it's enough.
Right.
It's never enough. You should be doing this and many more. As somebody is mentioning on the chat, you should have trust in your penetration team, in your security team. Sure you do. You need that. You need to do those regular security audits.
Yeah.
Again, that's just something else that you need to add to the pile to make sure that you catch problems before they become breaches. But again, not 100% secure, not 100% solution, because that simply does not exist.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I misspoke earlier. I meant to say people didn't know much about security or just starting out. But yeah, absolutely. Security is a great field to get into, even though we complain a lot because there's just a lot to complain about, you know. But that's also because we're here to educate you. And some of these things, it's just like, I can't believe they did what or didn't do what.
Speaking of they did what, AT&T. Yes, they've had quite a few breaches just this year and past year and the year before that and probably many more before that.
They're trying to, I heard that they're going to change their slogan. It used to be Rethink Possible. Remember that? I think they're going to change it to Rethink Vulnerable. Sorry, I had to put that in there.
You know, they don't have a presence here in Portugal. So I'm speaking completely looking just from the outside in. I have never had any experience with AT&T. It might just be unfair for me to be talking about AT&T in the first place. Just reading about their breaches and constantly seeing them in the news because of this, if I ever moved to a country where they provided any service, I would still look for a different ISP. But again, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, I have never used AT&T, so I've never been a customer. I make fun of it every now and then, you know, personally, but only because local friends do. It's an inside joke. I don't really know anything about AT&T other than they've been breached.
And how much of AT&T was breached this time? Well, 110 million customer data has been leaked.
Nearly all.
And what? I don't know how many customers AT&T has, but I suspect it shouldn't be too much more than many more than those, but yeah. So this isn't just the usual personal information. This is also things like your call history, made and received. In some cases, apparently, even the cell towers that were used, which means that you could be pinpointed to a particular location if you were part of the breach and you were in one of these, so they could tell exactly where you were when you made or received that call. And this goes back to a story that happened in the 80s, where, again, in the US, and again, I'm from the outside looking in, the VHS rental history became privileged information. You couldn't disclose that because apparently someone from Congress heard their VHS rental history leaked, and it wasn't very flattering to that person. Can you guess what will happen if this includes Congress people and they are calling their significant others who are not their spouses, for example, and this becomes public knowledge? This might become very problematic for very important people. So you might see some new legislation cropping up just from this alone.
I really wish adultery wasn't required to get legislation, but, you know, I digress. But there's definitely going to be we've seen it. You know, we're not just making up stuff. We've seen all kinds of unflattering things come out of this leak, that leak, this politician, that politician. And I agree. As soon as anything unflattering leaks out, if that were to happen, we'll have legislation tomorrow. Or at least looking into it tomorrow, but still, yeah.
Okay, now another interesting aspect of this. It's the same threat group, Snowflake, again, funny name, that was behind the Ticketmaster's breach. These guys have been making the news quite a lot recently. Quite a lot. Somebody is mentioning in the chat that it was a third-party breach. If it was AT&T data, and it was AT&T data that got leaked, and it was stored in the third party, it's still AT&T data, and it's still AT&T responsibility that it needs to be protected.
Shared responsibility.
You can't just offload your data and call it somebody else's problem. It's your data. If you try to pull that stunt here in Europe with GDPR information, you would be paying through the nose for each of those violations.
Right. I understand it's... At one point, it could look like the media is unfairly pointing the finger at AT&T, but we have to understand data ownership, like you mentioned. You know, at that point, you know, there's laws about where you can have it, you know, the criteria around that. There's retention laws. Like, nobody really thinks about that, especially when they start a job and they're managing backups. There's retention laws. There's this, there's that. But it is, to your point, yeah, all the cloud provider, third-party provider is providing a place for them to store the data. They're not mandating anything about how it's stored. And also, they didn't mandate multi-factor authentication either.
Again, multi-factor authentication. Why isn't that just the default setting everywhere on every single piece of software today? It blows my mind. Again, why are password dumps still a thing and still a problem? Make the passwords public for all I care if I have multi-factor authentication and there's no way you can get my second factor.
I can tell you why it's not popular. And it's a simple answer. It's the same reason why the year of the Linux desktop hasn't happened and won't. It's because people hate change. It's literally that simple. It could be like in the case of Linux and the Linux desktop, and I'll make this short, you could create a distribution that's 100% compatible with every single piece of software that was ever made or will be made. And it's the fastest, most user-friendly distribution on the planet, and nobody will switch to it. Why? Change. Nobody's going to go to multi-factor authentication. Why? They're anxious about change. Passwords are the thing they know. It's the thing they've been doing for 20, 30 years, however long. And sure, I think people understand there's a better way. I think a lot of people understand that. But to make somebody change, to make a company change, especially when you have a culture around your information systems, it makes it really hard to change. And with people hating change, you always have the entire company against you anytime you want to make a change for the silliest of reasons, which is why I feel like sometimes system administrator, especially security work, you could kind of feel like the bad guy, even though you're only trying to help, you know? So change is just so hard for people to deal with. And I am not excusing it, by the way. I'm not saying because change is hard, we have to go easy on people. No, if anything, I'm saying if change is hard and people are against it, we need to try even harder to educate them as to why they should do it anyway.
to that point, there's an argument that I go to whenever we're talking about this type of problem. IT is an incredibly conservative industry. I don't mean that in the political sense. I mean that people really like to do things the same way that they've always done it. As you were saying, they're averse to change. We're really quick at adopting new technologies, but boy, are we slow at changing the processes and the way that we use that technology. Take, for example, AI. AI gives you the ability to do many incredible things, but we're trying to shoehorn it into the processes that we are doing currently. That's why you're not seeing completely innovative tools with AI. You're seeing existing tools, but with an added flavor of AI added on top. And that applies to basically anything. An example that I use a lot on TuxCare, because we provide live patching tools. People are averse to changing the way that they do updates. So they would rather keep having maintenance windows and deploying updates and then rebooting their systems instead of changing to live patching and just having those updates applied automatically without any problem, simply because it's a different process than what they are used to and what they were brought into this field with. And it's incredible that you have this much easier, much faster, much more efficient process that you can adopt, and you're still doing things the very old way that you've always done it, simply because it's different than what you've always known. This is an incredibly conservative industry, in a surprising way, if you're looking from the outside in.
It really is, and I'll give you a fun little story. I don't know why I'm remembering this. When I was a Windows sysadmin a long time ago, I was on the phone with another Windows sysadmin, and we were working on a problem. And long story made short, it required me to edit the host file. So I know where in C Windows, System 32, whatever. I go in there, and I add a temporary IP address in the host file. And the person on the phone is, you know, we're doing a screen share. He sees it, and he's, "You're going into C Windows? Oh, you're editing a file in the operating system? Oh, wow, you're so ballsy. I can't believe you're doing that." I'm thinking it's a host file, right? But the reason why I bring that up is because that's the mentality, okay? Even going into C Windows for any reason, even to look at a file, you're going to make people nervous, okay? Making any change on a system, you're going to make people nervous because the system is the thing that creates change or represents change, I should say. And everyone hates change, so the change device will change again if you change something. I don't like changes. And I think, although it's not an excuse, that's exactly what we're running into.
And you see this at every level. It doesn't really depend on the size of the company. It doesn't matter if it's a smaller company or if it's a larger one. Anytime that you talk to them about, yeah, if you do this thing that's different from what you are doing, you can get this much better results or faster or more efficient or whatever you're trying to improve. And you know for a fact that that will work. Mm-hmm. Boy, does it take effort to convince them otherwise. Yeah, but we've always done it this way. What if it fails? What if this breaks and all of that? People are so afraid of making mistakes or of accidentally breaking stuff that they will fall back to whatever they are used and comfortable with. They never get out of their comfort zone, ever. And they're taught from whenever they started to do this job, they're taught that, yeah, this is how we do it, and that is how we're continuing to do it, and just do it like that, and that will work. And you're not really told why that's a good choice. You're not told why we're doing it that way instead of doing some other way. You're just told to go with the flow. Okay, this is how we do it, this is how you will do it, and everybody's going to be happy. And that leads to a whole host of problems. It leads to stagnation, it leads to stuff just breaking wherever they are and not being able to fix it because it's too old, and a whole host of other problems. But the underlying issue is that aversion to change and that really, really hard time that people have with changing the way that they're used to do stuff.
The first time I ever experienced this early in my career, I took this contract job for a mental health company, and I was really excited about it because it seemed like a job where I was going to make everyone happy. The job was they had over 100 Dell desktops that the company bought. It's time to refresh, and we're not talking 3 years refresh. I mean, it's probably been 5 or 6. I mean, these people are starving for a new machine, especially back then. So here I am thinking, everybody's going to be happy to see me. I'm the guy with the new computer, and I'm going to just upgrade everybody to the latest technology, I don't remember a single person being excited about it. I don't remember a single person being open to it. And here's a situation where you're giving everyone a much faster computer that's going to, you know, take care of everything. And to the company's credit, they had roaming profiles done and solid. Like, you log into a computer, you have your stuff. You don't care. It's there. It was great. Even then, faster computer, nobody was happy about it. Everybody was anxious, and practically everybody that worked there could not happen sooner that the whole project would be over. So if that's any indication, someone's getting a brand new computer, and we're just talking about their personal work device. We're not even talking about servers yet. We haven't even got to the server room yet, okay? And people already have a problem with change. So I know I'm beating this point, with a hammer at this point, but I think we just really need to focus on education. I think that's really the way forward, more so than ever. We have to sell it. As much as we don't think we have to sell a faster server or a better program, that it should speak for itself, it doesn't.
On the other end of the spectrum, it's important also to realize, and this is where experience becomes a key factor, not all change is good either. So take, for example, the massive mistakes that Microsoft has made with the start menu. Not all change is good. Not all the stuff that they are doing just because it's changing the way that the old one was working, that's not good per se. But you need to be able to discern when something is really an improvement from when it's just somebody trying to give you the latest marketing spiel. There is a difference. You should be more open to trying different things and seeing how different technologies can be used to their fullest. And then again, you should be able to discern of those which are the ones that are really useful and which are the ones that are just snake oil. And that is possible with enough experience and enough time and taking the time to look at them properly. Again, I really don't want to beat a dead horse on this one. So for the final story, and this is going to be a quick one as we're approaching our time, another important story that popped up is that Google is acquiring Wiz. Wiz is a cybersecurity startup. The acquisition will be done, according to the news, for $23 billion with a B, and that's a lot of money. That's about double the valuation that Wiz had just 2 months ago on the latest funding round that they did.
Oh my gosh.
So it's an incredible valuation for the company, and it's a huge amount of money for Google, so much so that it's the largest Google deal ever. Google has never paid so much for a company. So what is Wiz? If you're not familiar with, this company deals in cybersecurity for the cloud. They have products for handling container security and CI/CD pipelines, for example, like the one we talked about for GitHub, and they focus mostly on the cloud. It's important here that Google already has Mandiant. They acquired Mandiant, which is their cybersecurity arm. They acquired it 2 years ago. Joining both, they are becoming one of the largest presences in the cybersecurity space. If you're acquiring your cybersecurity services from a third party, it's very likely that you're going to be dealing with Google at some point in the future. So even if you weren't a Google customer previously, you might have become one with this acquisition. They claim to work with over 40% of the Fortune 100 companies, which is a lot. These guys are a really big business, if this is true. And Google really seems to be putting their money where their mouth is on cybersecurity. We've seen them having some problems with, for example, customer instances being deleted and gone forever. But this really shows at least that they're willing to spend a lot of money on cybersecurity efforts.
I'm hoping that this is something that's going to benefit everyone and not just Google Cloud, because I know that we had I can't remember what it was. We covered it a long time ago. It didn't make it, but there was this trusted build thing that Google wanted to do in their cloud platform. Remember that, where you had to have like a certain criteria to be authorized? I really hope it's not more of that. I hope this is something like, you know, everyone's going to benefit, or maybe a service everyone can use. But either way, it's good that they're spending time, money on security, no matter what. I just can't wait to see what they're going to do with it.
Yeah. At least from Mandiant, we know that they're doing cybersecurity research at the very least, if you're not a paying Google customer, you're at least getting their reports and their surveys and the information that they put out from different breaches and vulnerabilities, and that has been very useful. This is a type of information that can help everybody. And as long as everybody improves their security posture and we learn from the breaches that exist, it's more holes that we can keep try to plug as early as possible, because it will be less opportunities for attack. Again, not 100% secure, but it gives you more stuff to look at and make sure that you have it right.
We're just trying to close as many loops as possible. That's what security is. You'll always have loops to close, but it's your job to close any that you see and any that you find, and also to look for loops that you didn't close, that you missed. But with the understanding, both the employer has to understand and the security person has to understand, if, even at their best effort, there's still that possibility. But as long as if someone breaches, it's not for a lack of trying and you did the best you could, at least you could say that you're following the laws. At the end of the day, your recovery plan is what's going to save you.
Okay, and that's our episode for today. Thank you, everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. And until the next one.
See you next time.